Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest. My whole family is excited for this one. Joe Meganello is on the show. You may know him from, well, being fucking Deathstroke. You may also know him from being El Cid in True Blood. You may know him from his clothing line, Death Saves. You may even know him from Magic Mike XL. But today you will know him as a guest on Turned Out a Punk. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is where my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan, thank you for all the hard work you do. I love you, little buddy. And he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Left4Damien. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just by telling everyone you know that we do this podcast several times a week these days. And that'll be a great way to support it. You can also support it by subscribing to it and rating it on your podcast platform of choice, or by heading over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk and checking in over there. And thank you to all the people that do. Very much appreciated. And speaking of appreciation, my kind, loving appreciation to my friends at Vans who came aboard this podcast a few years ago and said, Damien, we believe in what you do. We just don't believe you should be doing it in your own pocket. And they helped me cover the cost of this thing. And for that, I really thank them. And yeah, I really, really do. Thank you very much to Vans for doing that. Also, head over to floodmagazine.com and check out Punk As Fuck, Punk AF. The series of videos I did with them a few years ago, they've been releasing them steadily and surely, and there are some great ones up there. Lots of cool guests from Bleach to Jonah Ray to Moby to all sorts of rad guests. Jay Howell's coming up. There's a lot of cool people on that, and there's more to come from them. And these were videos I recorded a while ago, and I'm glad you can finally see them because there's a lot of good stuff in there. So head out to floodmagazine.com and check those out. I think that's it. I think that's all we got here. Might as well start the show. Today on the show, Joe Meganello is here. And if you are, you definitely are familiar with Joe Meganello. He is someone who is, my whole family, my kids, my wife, everyone was really excited. And they're not very excited, you know, about guests. Well, they are, but separately, you know. They're not all excited at the same time about a guest normally. Joe is someone who I've been a fan of, seeing him in various movies for years, going back to Spider-Man. So the fact that he wanted to come on this little show right here and talk about punk rock, well, that blew me away. Joe is awesome. This was a really fun conversation. I'm so stoked I got to do it. Check out all the movies Joe makes. He's going to be in that Snyder Cut of Justice League that's coming out, as well as the film Arch Enemy that his production company put out, and Shoplifters of the World, which he talks about in this interview, and it sounds like an amazing movie. So both of those you got to check out, and the Snyder Cut, I'm sure. You know, the guy's a superstar. He's a superstar, and he's here. That tells you how powerful punk rock is, that we can pull these people in. And he's also, got this incredible clothing line, Death Saves, which is Dungeons & Dragons-inspired clothing. We talk about all this stuff in a second, so I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Joe Meganello on Turned Out a Punk.
That's funny.
Joe, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, there's a lot of things that we connect on. But what I spared you from off air, which I will now put you through now, is that I've done 300 episodes of this podcast, and there has never been a guest on it that the rest of my family has been more excited about at this point. Like, I have Deathstroke on the phone and El Cid, and my wife and my children are both beside themselves.
Wow. That's cool. Weird. Well, great.
You know, I think Mark Mothersbaugh, when I talked to him, it kind of was multi-generational like that, but I don't think my wife was as excited. So this is it's great to have you on the show. And I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Joe, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Oh, boy. Well, I think there were two big entry points for me. One would have been Henry Rollins. I was obsessed with Rollins. You know, Get in the Van. I think I read Get in the Van and then listen and subsequently listened to the audiobook when it came out. And then would have, backtracked obviously into all of the music and the albums that Rollins was talking about, both in going to see those shows, work, taking days off of the Haagen-Dazs to go up to New York to see those shows, those old DIY shows and kind of, hangarounds in DC. And then, of course, when he was asked to become the lead singer of Black Flag, I went through all of that at that point. I would say that was my entry point, definitely. But the other side of it is there was this kind of side door because of Metallica. Metallica started releasing some covers, and one of them was Last Caress, which is how I found out about the Misfits. So actually, I found out about like Danzig, the Misfits, via Metallica, because I initially thought, oh, this is a Metallica song, but it doesn't sound like the rest of their stuff. Oh, wait, no, this is by this band called the Misfits.
It's amazing how many people come on the show, and it's Metallica is such a gateway because they obviously are so popular, but they are making those reference points to even like bands like Discharge, right? On Garage Days, they're doing like Discharge covers, which is, digging pretty deep for like a popular band to be doing.
Yeah, so you wind up getting into the influences of your influences, and a lot of times with bands, I mean, obviously, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, but that's a great way to let an audience know this is who I am, or if you like them, you'll like me and here, and so yeah, Metallica, when they really started getting popular, really, I think, gatewayed a lot of people into a lot of different types of music.
Where were you hearing about the, getting the van and Rollins at the time?
I had a friend of mine, had a friend of mine who was from DC, and he said, "Hey, have you ever read this?" And I said, "No." And he said, "You got to read it. It's the greatest book ever written." And that was it. It was a friend who got me into it. Then I got the CDs, which were like awesome because me as an actor, as an artist, the people that I really respected or when I was coming up were people like, Eric Bogosian, people who they were actors, they were also writers, they were playwrights, they were journalists, and Rollins fit into that category. Rollins also was into working out, which for me, I was also an athlete, not just an artist growing up. And so to find someone who merged together the two Greek ideals, philosophy and training, for me, it was like, okay, that's my dude. And then I just followed him all the way up through. I mean, literally followed him also. Like I have pictures of he and I. He played a Pittsburgh show. I went to Carnegie Mellon University, and Rollins came and spoke. And my girlfriend at the time was part of the committee that booked him and was handling him. And so she's like, "You want to come meet him afterwards?" She's like, "Come with me. Surprise me. Come on, come on." And then she pulled me into this room, and there was Rollins, and I had about 5 minutes to hang out and talk with him. And so, both literally and figuratively, I followed that guy around and had all of his books, all went to all of his book signings. Like I just, I was obsessed with him. And it started with a friend who was from DC.
It's funny to think about like how big of a cultural figure he was in like the late 80s and into the 90s. Like, he's obviously retreated and he's still a huge musical legend, but like in terms of just like guy, he was doing Gap commercials and Mac stuff. Like he was just like a crossover star.
Well, that was a thing. Yeah, I thought about that a lot actually, in his approach. And now that we have perspective, because now he's in this like new phase where he's kind of like, the aging, get off my planet guy. I won't even say get off my lawn, because I think that would be restrictive in a global sense. He's the get off my planet guy. but looking back at, what he represented, or how involved he was with MTV, and all of the other, media outlets, like you said, the Gap, and where he was popping up in movies, like in The Chase playing a cop when he had just ranted on album after album about how much he hated cops from back in the Black Flag days. Here, if you want to play this one, or Johnny Mnemonic. So it was like, I think he was a real pioneer in that way. There were people afterwards that certainly made a lot more money and will probably be, remembered on a larger scale than Henry. But Henry blew those doors open, and I think he made it popular while retaining the soul, I think, of what punk is about. He didn't, you know, I mean, it was like he was comp, you know, you could say, oh, he's compromising in that Gap ad, but he's actually getting mainstream eyeballs on something very, very subversive that is delivering a very poignant message, more poignant than the mainstream would be brave enough to present. And I think that that was important at the time.
Yeah, and I think like once you're involved in something, you tend to have a sense of ownership that prevents you from seeing how important this kind of outreach stuff is. Like, you know, like you need the Metallicas covering these bands to kind of bring people in. Otherwise, it's just going to die off if it's too much of a closed circle.
That's right. And I remember, you know, so I'm good friends with Shepard Fairey. And you know, Shepard obviously is very good friends with Rollins and has done a lot of collaborative stuff with him. You know, and I remember at some point during the Magic Mikes, when the Magic Mike movies were being released, you know, I was tiring of these stupid questions that I was getting in my press tour. And it was really pissing me off when people would say, you know, we'd come in there and rather than talk about the work or how much fun we had, or, you know, it was, did you learn any stripper moves that you took home to your wife?
Yeah.
Far from having an artistic conversation about anything, you know, it just felt like I was off on this branch of like, you know, sellout city. It's like, I just did two movies with Steven Soderbergh and Greg Jacobs and, you know, McConaughey, who just won an Oscar. And, you know, you don't, none of that was being talked about. And there's a part of me that understood that, but there was also another part of me that was like, man, I am really far from home. And, you know, what was cool about, you know, Shepard was like, look, man, you have a mainstream audience that a lot of subversive people don't have. And you're going to be able to, at some point, if they ever print it, or listen to what you're saying, be able to deliver, you know, a cool message to, you know, to a mainstream audience or a subversive message to a mainstream audience. Just keep that in mind. You know, this is building towards something. And it was that conversation with Shepard that kind of put me straight. It was like, are you selling out or, you know, are you expanding an audience that wouldn't normally listen to your type of music, which is kind of like a segue into like thrash metal, which is like, look at what Metallica did. You know, they took a lot of heat for what they did. And it felt like they were abandoning, you know, thousands of their fans. But what happened was millions of people then came in through the door and started like people who never would have listened to Ride the Lightning are now listening to Ride the Lightning.
Well, and I think like, look at what, like I was watching a video that you did recently where you're answering people's questions about D&D, and it was just mind blowing because I went to Dungeons and Dragons summer camp for like 8 years. And
oh
it felt like
God.
I was listening to like one of my counselors, like the shit you were dropping in there. I'm like, I'm taking notes. I'm like, oh shit, that makes sense about having names on your DM screen. Like why you got to think of so many stupid names all the time. Like, why wouldn't you have that list there? You know, like the stuff you're saying, it's like, it's so weird to see that being brought into like a mainstream forum. And like growing up in the 80s and into the 90s where there was like legit hate for D&D, like,
sure,
you did something with D&D, like people were like, oh shit, that kid's a Satanist, or that's like, you know, pre-Trenchcoat Mafia, that was the Trenchcoat Mafia, were the Dungeons and Dragons kids. And so,
oh yeah, for sure. I mean, they were the ones who had on the Misfits t-shirts and were listening to Metallica. Like that's, and I mean, look at like Paradise Lost and the West Memphis Three. Like there were kids that went to jail.
Yeah.
Because they thought because they wore all black and listened to Metallica, they were murderers.
Yeah. No, yeah, oh God,
that's like, the only criteria you needed to nail somebody to the wall, and Dungeons and Dragons was that way. You know, the interesting thing is like, you know, Dungeons and Dragons is like kind of that, like it was like DIY, you know, straight out of Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. We're selling these little boxes out of the trunk of our car off the porch of our house, and this thing just catches fire and takes off, but then becomes corporatized, and then now you have this conglomerate that's making decisions about where this like super hardcore creative scary brand was supposed to go. And what they're doing is they're defanging it and making it safe. Yeah. And the beauty of Dungeons and Dragons, as opposed to all the other games like Candyland, or, you know, I mean, you could get into all the other tabletop role-playing games. The thing D&D had going for it was the fact that it was scary. That's what made it exciting. You know, as soon as it was satanic or pseudo satanic, they sold four times as many books the following year. So there's something that I love about, and you know, I started a streetwear line basically to try to keep that spirit alive where you felt like you were doing something you shouldn't be doing, and keep it punk, you know, as it's being corporatized.
Yeah, and I think that was actually my first exposure to the concept of a sellout and to be like into poser shit was the idea of like when I went to that camp, we all played first edition. Even though I was a kid and all my books were second edition, I came in the first day, they're like, never bring those books back here. You don't need them, you know, because it was like you're saying, those were the corporate version of this thing that was viewed as being pure. And obviously we're like, what, fifth generation now, right? So we've moved a few generations past this thing, but that was like the first place I was introduced to this idea of like, no, that's not the real shit. This is the real shit.
Yeah, but it's also great to have that education because you want to understand where it came from. For example, like when D&D first hit the scene, it wasn't listed as a role-playing game. Mm-hmm. It was listed as a war game. It was the first war game that involved playing a role, where instead of being in charge of an entire army or Napoleon's forces in Russia, instead you're one soldier in that army. So you get to name your soldier, you get to, you know, come up with a backstory for your soldier. It just, you know, it created a second half, a flip side of the coin, which was, I think, what really made it super popular. But, you know, it wasn't a role-playing game, it was a war game. So understanding where it came from and the intentions, you know, in the beginning, and also being able to mark, you know, with flagpoles where it deviated from that path or was forced to deviate because of, you know, bothered about Dungeons and Dragons and all the religious groups that came up and tried to destroy it and burn the kids' books. Like understanding that history, you understand what's at the fabric and at the core of it. It's like, you know, reading the Bible in ancient Greek or, you know what I mean? Or like studying, you know, ancient math, like learning, you know, learning Hebrew to read the old original scriptures in, you know, the hand that they were written in. That's right. Yeah. It's like, you know, you get an understanding of where the game is, and then you get an understanding of like what needs to be preserved out of it as we go through. Like we're in a phase right now where I think fantasy for people is like, you know, lollipop hammers and unicorns pooping rainbow sherbet, and that's D&D now. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, you know, you can go make the D&D My Little Pony crossover. I understand. Mm-hmm. But for another generation, fantasy is Conan the Barbarian, you know, and John Milius and Valeria. And, you know, he's wearing a loincloth. She's wearing a metal bikini. Like we're all equal here, you know, but we're running around and cutting heads off and lighting people on fire, which is what the game is about. Mm. So you can attempt to take that out or pretend that it's not that, but, you know, understanding where it comes from, I guess that was long winded, but there you go.
No, it's funny. Cause like it is something where we're at this moment where everything is commodified and everything is becoming corporatized, you know, and there's like a version of something that's kind of like mass marketable, but it's like with Dungeons and Dragons, like anything else, I guess there's also this side of it where it's like, no, there's also this thing where it came from, like this sort of like the DIY side of Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
You're tracking down old books and you're like buying old stuff so you can kind of keep playing like the original version of the thing.
That's right. And it's like, look, you can go into Hot Topic and you can buy your pop punk t-shirt. Mm-hmm. Okay. And your black lipstick and your eyeliner and your manic panic, you know, there's that, but let's not forget about, you know, the people going to score heroin in the Lower East Side, you know, in the late 70s, you know, early 80s, like, you know, that's where this came from. That's where this was birthed. Now I understand it's there and that's fine, but like, you know, it was scary and it was real and the best stuff came from that period, or, you know, the best grapes grew out of that soil. So let's not forget that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and also I guess going back to like high school, you know, like being the fact that you're like into D&D, like you are, into heavy metal, into sports, into acting. Like, was it like what was high school like where you went, where you could be in all these different like lunch tables at once?
Yeah, I was friends. I had a lot of different friends, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I'd walk in to school past the street corner where everybody was smoking cigarettes and I'd have my Skid Row t-shirt on and I'd kind of point over and the kids that were smoking would wave and say, what's up? And I'd go in and, And I was good at school, and then I had the, so I had the academic friends, I had the friends on the sports teams that I hung out with and had the keg parties with on Friday nights, and then I had my friends that I would wake up super early on Sunday morning to go shoot movies with, and then I had my D&D friends that I ran games with, or other games. And so I had a there was a lot to cultivate, I guess, is what I'm saying. So I think what that meant was that I was going to be a late bloomer. Like, I was going to do okay as we went along, but it was going to be a late bloomer because there was just a lot of balls to keep in the air, and a lot of a lot to develop. Basically, I never came home after school. I never didn't have a million things to do during the summer. I was always busy. But yeah, I mean, it's like, of course I wound up in the arts because it was the one place where I could to have the best chance at utilizing all these weird skills and interests in all these different areas.
Yeah, I guess there's like not a lot of careers in role-playing games at that time, you know? Like how like what
Yeah.
are there, like being a writer, I guess, at that point, and an artist obviously too.
Yeah, I think when I was younger I wanted to work at TSR,
Yeah,
but
then you
that
find
was
out the
my dream. But
politics.
I didn't think you were allowed to do that. I was actually talking to a friend of mine who works at Wizards of the Coast, who own and shepherd Dungeons and Dragons, and we were having a talk, and I was like, man, I just didn't think I was allowed to have that job. But here I am as an adult. They've been great, about allowing me to play in the sandbox, and I've been able to, write stories and create characters and, work on modules with them. And and then I, have like some of my characters then appear in video games and things like that. And they have, figures that are sold in, six packs that you can buy in a toy store or a gaming store. So it's like, whew, okay. Like, we are getting through a lot of these things on the list. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I am not, I'm getting closer to, I regret nothing.
You need
This
that
is great.
Rollins buddy pitcher, though.
You don't understand. Anytime people would ask me, they would say for years, because I, produce films too, and it's like, who do you want in this film? Who would you like to work with? And it used to be like there was a trifecta. It was David Bowie, Henry Rollins, and Tom Waits. And so yes, I've got to get something going with Rollins, man, for sure. So I directed a one night only staged reading of the movie Major League, and I cast I mean, put my own cast together. Rich Eisen came in and did the stage directions. Thomas Lennon played, the Bob Uecker role. I cast Billy Gardell was Coach Lou Brown. I cast my wife Sophia as Pedro Serrano. Right, and I mean, it was like hilarious. It was amazing. But I had initially called Rollins to come in, and I think I was maybe gonna cross cast him as the owner of the team. It was either the owner of the team or the part that Billy played. It was like one or the other. I was like, if I can get Rollins, like, I'll slot him into somewhere. he was busy. I think it was like Ian McKay's birthday the next day, and he had to go to, so it was like, all right,
He's got
good
priorities.
excuse.
That's nice to
That's a
know
good
you're still,
excuse. I'll accept that. That's cool. So no, I've always been happy. I just love him and would love to, be able to spend more time with him.
Was there any like weirdness between these other friends that you had and like the fact that you did like hang out with the metal and D&D kids, or was like everyone kind of chill about it? Because as we went got back, there was that satanic panic kind of going on.
Yeah, there was. I remember, as I was running games and things, role playing games for my friends. I remember, kids' moms coming to me and yanking them out of the game and telling me I should watch out and stuff like that. So I remember that there was a presence of that had penetrated my, my neighborhood. As far as, I mean. Yeah, I remember in the cafeteria, a kid I was friends with who was, one of the kids that was always doing LSD after school and was kind of wild and out there, and this, artist, this real skateboarding artist kid that I was friends with. I didn't join him in those acid parties after school because I had practice and I had weightlifting. So, I was always, I was pretty straight edge through high school for the most part, with athletics. That really kept me out of trouble, but it wasn't to say that I wasn't friends with those kids or didn't like those kids. And I remember one of the other captains on the football team was picking on that kid. And I stepped in and was like, leave him alone. And if you're going to fight him, you have to fight me first. And, I did that whole thing. So there was conflict in a way sometimes between, but, it was like back then it was, everybody was fighting with everybody else. So, I don't know what to say.
Yeah, it was like a lot more. Well, I don't know. Like, I'm not in school now, so I can't say, but, and my kids are pretty young at this point, but it seems like it was a lot more kind of like, oh, you're this type of kid. You're this type of kid. Like, you had to pick your kind of like little group that you were going to be in, and that's where you stayed. That's why it's
And
awesome that
you
you.
remember, well, you remember record stores.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, if you didn't look like a punk rocker or metalhead and you're in the metal section, I mean, first of all, there's like 800 subgenres of music now. And back in the day, we had six. There were six sections in a music store, and that was it. And it was like, if you didn't look like you belonged in one of the sections, then it was like somebody might say something to you or look at you funny. It was like a funny, it was a really funny thing.
I think it comes out of youthful insecurity, and I think it also comes out of the fact that, everything was, like, you only had so much money. So you were like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to buy these records and this shirt, and this will be my identifier as who I am, versus like, I'm going to be able to afford these D&D books, or, like, there's just only so much money to kind of like go to these events and things like that. So I think you had to choose a lot more than now, where it's just like, if you can afford the streaming, you can afford to see it all and take it all in.
But yeah, that's right. You had to pick a side, and that was your side. And there was also a sense of identity to being in one of these gangs, really, very much. And very people were very much more snobby about what kind of music you listen to, which is why I think selling out was such a big deal, because it was like you have to be very protective of your image. It was a difference between, what Metallica was doing out of San Francisco. You think about them in like, denim jackets and a metal tee underneath, or like a some Manowar tee or something under, or Sam Hain t-shirt, you know what I mean? Or Cliff Burton in a Misfits shirt with a denim jacket over the top. But then you go down to LA and it's like all the guys are in high heels and makeup.
Yeah, it was like a very, like, everything was taken up very regionally, like, you look at music and the idea that you could have regional hits back then, like a song that only is popular because, like, an artist like UGK and rap music that, like, basically were the kings of the South, like, kings of Texas, and yet you don't really hear of them on the radio if you're kind of anywhere north. Certainly in Canada, we weren't hearing about them.
No, that's right. And it was like, you had to go get a magazine and read the magazine to find out what your band, favorite band was doing. And that came out like once a month. So you get the magazine, you read that, then you go in the back, you'd start mailing letters to places to get a copy of that tape or that bootleg or that t-shirt. And you just kind of like mailed your, try to fold the paper so that you could hide your cash in the envelope. No one would open it up and steal it. And you just prayed that thing came back in 6 to 8 weeks. And that's how you did it, And there was like a real commitment. And like you said, it's like you only had so much money. So like I remember listening to Ride the Lightning for 18 months straight without listening to another tape. I just flipped it and flipped it and flipped it. Oh, it's time for homework. Boom, side A. Boom, side B. And that was how I went for a year and a half. And then I was like, shit, okay, I'll get Master of Puppets. That looks cool.
No, it's amazing how intimately you get to know a record, because, like you're saying, you had to listen to it over and over again because that's all you had. So
So I had, yeah.
you studied it. Like, there's a relationship to music that I think is different when you have to sacrifice for it, just because you put, like, your blood and sweat into it. Like, when you make the food for yourself versus buying it.
Yeah, very much. No, I mean, but that's also like this is like when you get into like Fight Club, which is the whole crux of Fight Club. It's like, we're men who traditionally were hunting our food, and now we go to the people can go to the grocery store and buy their food. So what's the purpose of us anymore? And what are we doing here? And, you know, it's this exploration of where does that energy go? And I think at that time, I think, you know, that energy was celebrated more, or at least talked about more, because there were these, you know, whether it was punk, you know, or the first mosh pits, or, you know, my first concert, which was Pantera, Sepultura, Biohazard, you know,
that's
like
a hard ass show. Oh my God.
First concert. So, you know,
how
on
old
the
are
second,
you?
On the second leg of a Vulgar Display. So, oh, you know, it was like when you catch those concerts you went to at that point in time, when only those three albums were out, or only those two albums were out, it was like, those are the greatest hit shows, basically, yeah, that you saw as the bands were coming up. And I guess I was 16, I want to say. 16.
Was it a violent show? I can imagine it would have been nuts.
Well, you know, there were mosh pits, and then there was a Pantera show where, you know, lots of skinheads, mm-hmm. lots of dudes with head tattoos that you're pretty sure are some sort of, you know, mean something, let's say. Mm-hmm. And it's like there were punches thrown. Friend of mine I went with from the football team got the shit kicked out of him in a pit. You know, it was dangerous, man. Some of those shows were like borderline dangerous. You had to really keep your wits about you and be smart.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Like, and it's like the divide, you know, cause like you're finding out about these bands on TV or maybe through, you know, the music magazine where they're all side by side, but the difference between a show like that versus, you know, even a Metallica show back then would have been night and day.
Yeah. I will say this though. Metallica played off the Live Shit Binge and Purge box set. And I went to that show and, sad. Lane Staley had a heroin overdose, not the fatal one, but a heroin overdose right before the show. And so I didn't get to see Alice in Chains and Metallica on the same show. And that was a bummer, man. But anyway, at this Metallica show, you know, there was the pit, then there was the stadium seating, and then there was the field. And the field just went on as far back as the eye could see. And this thing happened at that show when Metallica came on where this people went to each side like Braveheart. You know, here's the British are over there and the Scottish are over here. And they would wait and someone in the middle would like, you know, UFC, you ready? Are you ready? Let's get it on. And both sides would just run at each other.
Wall of death at each other.
It was like, I remember I was in the seats at that point. I was in the pit and then I came back to my seat and I turned around and was like, oh my God, you know, it was medieval, what they had cooked up for that one. And then there were just like bodies in the middle and they would kind of come in and clear out the dead and then they'd go again.
Yeah. Yeah. That is definitely, I guess that's the thing about Metallica is they're so big that just that sheer number of people is going to be way more dangerous than any mosh pit could ever be.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I guess like, I heard a rumor. Well, I read online, I should say, that you roadied for Goldfinger. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Well, yeah. I mean, I had like, you know, like there's prison and then there's country club prison, yeah. You know, there are roadies and then there's like, I was country club roadie. So, you know, I was best friends with John Feldman, still am. Anyway, called me up and he's like, hey man, you ever been to Australia and New Zealand? I was like, no. He's like, you want to come? I'm like, yeah, sure. So, he put me on payroll as his security, which, you know, meant like, I got to like throw drunken kids off the stage, you know, in Brisbane, Australia. And, you know, John would throw his guitar over to the side and, you know, I'd catch it out of the air and, you know what I mean? Hand it over to the sound tech Cadaver. That was his name. And, you know, so it was like, yeah, it was fun, man. It was a good time. So, but yeah, I definitely, I'm an actor. I like traveling. I like that. I like the rock and roll lifestyle, man. It's cool.
Was that like a festival tour that they were on?
They played, you know, I know they played like four sold out shows at a club in Melbourne. So no, it wasn't necessarily, festivals. It was their own gigs.
Okay.
Just bouncing around.
That's the best place to tour though.
Yeah. And then they came back to the States and I would always, you know, I would go to their shows in the States, which were some festivals, you know, like they'd play, I don't know, like the Warped Tour and stuff like that. I'd go hang out with John backstage.
Did you ever see them come through Pittsburgh? Like, did you know them through there back then?
No, I didn't. I mean, I knew their music, obviously, but no, I didn't. When they would have been touring, I was in drama school, which meant I was booked, like, 6 days a week, 8 in the morning till 1 in the morning, I'm busy. And so I just didn't that I didn't know anything that was going on in the world other than the cover, front cover of USA Today in the newspaper box, on my way to school. I just didn't, I didn't know what was happening. I was just working.
Like I guess at the same time, like Anti-Flag and all those bands would have been kind of popping off in Pittsburgh. Like, were you aware of those bands? Whereas once again, like something that you're just kind of focused on the craft at this point.
No. Well, even in high school, there's a, so my first film as a director, my first feat, well, I should say my first feature as a director, was this documentary called LeBear. And my director of photography is a guy I went to high school with, named Andrew Wheeler, and he's this AFI award-winning cinematographer. And so he shot that movie. And then the movie I produced, which is actually relevant to our conversation, is a movie called Shoplifters of the World, which is about the day the Smiths broke up in 1987. And so we made this movie about this urban legend that Morrissey talked about in a Details magazine, 90s Details magazine, article about a kid who was such a huge Smiths fan, and he was so distraught when they broke up that he held up his local heavy metal station in Denver, Colorado, at gunpoint and forced the DJ to play nothing but Smith's records all night long so that the kid could impress this girl he was in love with. And so we made this movie about it, and I play the metal DJ, Full Metal Mickey, Full Metal Mickey, Kiss 101, and I do the whole, and I love my metal. And Ozzy was so kind as to, Ozzy and Sharon gave us Bark at the Moon for the
That's
beginning of the
awesome.
movie. So like that's what comes on and you're introduced to me, All Night Denver, Bang Your Heads with, Ozzy playing. And then the kid and I have this interface through the movie where, I impart on him my heavy metal wisdom, while also creating an appreciation for the Smiths, and he does the reverse. And so it's kind of like this, Sam Shepherdy, True Westy kind of, merging of the minds between the, the mopey Smiths fan and the, aggro metalhead. And so anyway, where was I? Where did I start where I went on this crazy tangent like
We're
that?
talking about AFI. Oh, we're talking about
Oh, we're talking
Anti-Flag, the
about, yeah,
band.
so this guy Andrew Wheeler. So he was actually a punk, he was a punk musician. He was in a punk band called, I believe, Reagan Squad is the name of the band.
God Squad
and
or Reagan Squad?
Reagan Squad.
Reagan
And
Squad, okay.
they played out quite a bit. And so I knew that he was into, like, all the Pittsburgh punk, the Pittsburgh punk scene. And so I was definitely aware of it, but in high school, like I said, I never had a night where I went and did something. I had school, then I had practice or a game, and then the weekends were practice or film sessions or games and stuff. So I wasn't a really big part of the, the that scene, where I think in high school, during the summers, like I said, I would go to the big thrash metal shows, or like, it was like Pantera, Sepultura, Biohazard gave way to, White Zombie and Danzig, and of course Metallica. The Deftones had just started up that time, and I knew about them, so I'd go see them. So yeah, I had my bands, but I just wasn't, but anyway, my DP was very involved and still is. And it's, he has a really great, I think his punk sensibility creates a certain aesthetic when he shoots film. He sees things with a certain eye. He's not afraid to catch the grime or catch the character, let's put it, of, of a certain location, or, he makes things look more real, which I really like.
So were you kind of like aware of any sort of like local Pittsburgh bands at that time, like metal bands even? Because there's such a it's such an amazing city. Like even now there's that band Code Orange. I don't know if you've heard them. They've kind of popped up there, but there's like a such a vibrant kind of continuum of music coming out of that place.
When I was there, it was like Rusted Root and the Clarks. That those are the Pittsburgh bands. Rusted Root especially. They were the big band. So as far as all that went, I had a friend of mine who had a He was obsessed with Mr. Bungle, so he had a Mr. Bungle-esque band, like a kind of like a Mike Patton, very heavily influenced, kind of deal. But at the time, I'm trying to think of what was going on in Pittsburgh. I mean, it was like drum and bass had hit Pittsburgh, and that was like surprisingly, a ton of places had drum and bass bars and drum and bass nights all the time. So it was like. But yeah, as far as back then, no, I wasn't like aware or going to see homegrown metal bands at that time. I was, like I said, I was busy when during the summer when all those, the touring bands would come through.
So your first movie's Spider-Man, right? Was that the first like sort of big national film that you did?
Yeah, first professional film, yeah.
What was so were you familiar obviously with like Sam Raimi and Evil Dead before that?
Yeah, of course. No, I knew Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, Army of Darkness. Sure, I knew Sam and Darkman. So I knew Sam, and I thought that his sensibility was really interesting. And for I think the potential quirkiness of there could be a thread of quirkiness. It was I think at the time it was like, well, I was very curious to see what he did with the script in terms of the humanity of the character. And I think that's what, really I think blew the genre open was that Sam made a superhero human and very, very relatable. And I thought that that was something that forever changed. All the superhero movies that came afterwards really had to, they had to hire great actors and they had to really keep things grounded in a real humanness. And I think Sam nailed that.
It's kind of like the way Evil Dead did with horror films too. And like I guess Evil Dead 2, even though it's more of a comedy at that point, but just like the psychology of that movie and how like everything that kind of came after it in the genre was forever affected by it, even when they're rejecting it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting, this conversation, like we're talking about a lot of the people who were pioneers and kind of marking with flags, like where what they did changed everything that came afterwards.
No, I think that's the thing about I don't know, that's the thing about culture that like it's always these outsiders that end up making the thing that changes it, like that disrupts it, and not in a sort of present day disruptor kind of sense, but like,
Sure.
just the idea of like, just changing the world around you through doing stuff on your own.
Yeah, and I think, it's interesting because we talk about punk and I read the Beastie Boys book over the summer and they grew up during that punk era that we're talking about and CBGBs and everything that was going on down there in southern Manhattan and but then they became corporatized and to a certain degree or commoditized and they really didn't like what they had become, I think artistically, and there was something inside of them screaming at them in their gut to get off of this train, and who knows when that other train comes in, if it even comes in, but we've got to go do something else, and that's the gut instinct to not make License to Ill 2 and instead make Paul's Boutique.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Like, how many artists make their best album the third record in, and just completely change where they're going? Like, it's really rare to kind of see, them a group do that. Obviously including their punk stuff as like a whole album, but like they really find their direction kind of at their lowest point commercially.
Yeah, and that's just it's just part of that artistic trip. It's like Metallica's Black Album. It took me a while to really fully say, okay, I'm gonna get into this because there weren't 8 minute long songs on basically some kind of experimental album where every song is about death. It's like I don't want to listen to it if it's not that. They were attempting to go somewhere where the muse was taking them, and I think that that's incredibly important because, like I said, it's like, say what you want about the Kardashians wearing Metallica shirts or whether or not they actually do listen to Slayer in their free time. I don't know. Who cares? But the fact is, like, it's kind of rad that you can't find a vintage Metallica shirt for under $2,000. I think that there's something cool about that and vindicating to me about that, that like this little band that had no radio play and no videos, you know, is now like the most coveted t-shirt you can find. It's like, okay, I think that's kind of rad. And I think that that to me is right. That's right. You know, something feels right about that.
I don't know. I think it's kind of a bummer that I can't find a you know, Pusshead Metallica shirt for less than $2,000 now. But
I hey, no, what you're check saying. Out the company. The company Made Worn.
Yeah.
Do you know that company? There's a company Made Worn. They've gone around the world.
Yeah.
And they found all the bootlegs that were sold illegally outside of the concerts.
Yeah.
And they found out who made them all illegally, and then they went and cleared them with all the bands.
Well, so they got so all the screens actually, now.
And they print them on the material. They found a way to do the way the lead paint used to crack. They found out a way to make that kind of paint that cracks like that without the lead in it.
Yeah.
And they've have like all the old sewing machines. So all those shirts are sewed and they're made to the exact specifications that they were back. And they feel like they've been pulled out of a trunk. And go to their site because they've got all the old Pusshead stuff. They've got, Short of Straw, Vertigo, like everything. And then there's like great, like, you know, they've got all the great Misfit shirts. They've got all the great Ozzy stuff, Black Sabbath, like Stones, I mean, Grateful Dead. Like they've even got like Tupac and Biggie, like they've got like everything. And I think you would, and it's not $2,000.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's a little more than my price range is. As a dad, it's been amazing to kind of watch all these things. Like you're saying, it's kind of vindicating to watch, like, you know, yourself through Death Saves and D&D or just like, you know, all these things that I liked as a kid that weren't necessarily cool. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember being like laughed at a party for trying to put a Cramps record on as a teenager feeling vindicated when they were on 90210, you know, like it just feels like that's what's happening on a mass scale now. Like all these things that you're like, yeah, these were cool. We were right. Like these people were wrong around.
Well, but
us.
You're also like, you're going to put on that Cramps record and one person at the party is going to be like, that was rad. You know, one person. Now the other 99 are going to like hate you, but the one's like, all right, we're friends. You know, whereas now with the internet, I think what cool or what was experimental, like, I guess during this phase of my life or career or creativity or whatever was like, you know, it was like, there are like millions of people out there who are into this. Now we were all scattered to the wind at the day, you know, back in the '80s, it was hard to find who the weirdos were unless they really just, you know, flew the freak flag and were part of the Trenchcoat Mafia. Then you're like, oh, okay, those guys are probably into D&D and Metallica, I bet. But you know, without that, it's like, you just wouldn't know who all the weirdos are. Now with the internet, this is actually one of the positives of the internet, is like these like groupings that get created of like at the record store. You know, like the sections are there. It's like, so what I started doing was talking about it publicly, putting myself out there publicly. And what happened was all these people came back to me and were like, hey, we're into that. We like that. Thanks for speaking out about it. I don't feel so embarrassed when I talk about it. Like that kid that was getting bullied by the jocks, you know, or by one of my football captains, you know, I should, you know, picked on. Mm-hmm. And I stepped in. It's like, in a way, it's like, hey, stop picking on these kids. We're all grown up now. You know, if you like, you know, Game of Thrones, I was created by two guys who grew up playing D&D. So, you know, shut up because you surrendered your Sunday nights for a decade to these two guys. So yeah. Be thankful and understand where their fountainhead of creativity came from. You know, it's like my D&D group is, you know, Tom Morello. It's like, do you like Rage Against the Machine? You think they're cool? Okay. He's like the most hardcore D&D gamer I've met. Email from Tom about what he wants to do with his character and his polar bear mount. Okay. Like, you know, like this is like real stuff. Vince Vaughn started character building and building characters playing D&D in Chicago where he grew up, and The Big Show. Like you go on and on. All of us cut our teeth on this stuff. So there's a bit of it to kind of let everybody know, look, we're a generation of people who were influenced, heavily influenced by these things. And in the true sense of the 80s, there are a lot of things that fit under one umbrella. You know, it's like, you know, we all hung out in the comic book stores. We all hung out in the arcades. We all, you know, played Dungeons and Dragons. We all had a Led Zeppelin poster on the wall and a, You know, we had Metallica Pusshead t-shirts, like all of us. This was a collected experience. We didn't know that we were all putting all those pieces together. So that's why I started my streetwear line, Death Saves, because it's like a combination of all of that in the spirit of you know, that era and that energy that like we were onto something and we were part of this secret society. And the more that like the parents and the churches and the government, the grown-ups spoke out about it, the more we were driven towards it and it made it cool. And so let's not forget all of that, like you were saying. Let's not forget history. Like let's keep that alive because, you know, that's where this thing came from. And you know, I'm trying to like keep it pure in a way.
Yeah, no, and I think it's also like that's the original thing that calls all these interesting people, you know, first off, because it's like one of the first outlets that you have as a young person where it's like now you got to use your imagination. Like you're not just playing with someone else's imagination. It's up to you to visualize everything and to create this world. You know, and it's you know, like it's not like a toy or even a video game. Like you're really starting from scratch with it.
No, it was incredibly helpful for me as an actor, as a producer especially. You know, it was incredibly helpful. And I mean, I was working out my 10,000 hours before I even knew that was a job that you could have. You know, I just thought working for TSR, there's, I don't know how you do that, you know, and I'm not, you know, I don't know. Oh, but wait, there's this thing where you can like write dialogue and what the characters say, and you can make them do anything, and you can write these backstories, and you know, I could be a werewolf for 5 years on a TV show. A guy transforms into a wolf. Okay, that's cool. I could be a guy with a mohawk and an eye patch with a sword and a shotgun who wants to kill this guy in a bat suit. Yeah, all right, I'll do that. You know, like to me, that was the bridge for me. It was kind of like all of the things that I loved about tabletop gaming and story creation or mythology, I could put into this career that here we are, you know, I'm 2 decades in. And, you know, I'm just kind of now getting closer to that nucleus of like what drove me to be creative in the first place. And I really think for me, that's what it is. It's kind of a march back into my childhood and what kept me up all night, what I couldn't wait to wake up and keep thinking about more, write about, and you know, create. And so I'm trying to do that now. And what's really cool is we're at a time in Hollywood where, you know, example, like, you know, my movie Arch Enemy that's out, it's kind of like what if Superman landed on the wrong planet, which is completely taken from all the what if comics that I used to read hanging around the, you know, the comic book stores and the arcades. So we now have the technology to do it, and we can make these stories, and I'm in a position where I can. So you know, I've tried to unify that audience or see who all those people are out there who are into the same things that I am or like those things, and now I'm trying to get in position to really, you know, create the content and do it right, whether that's with somebody else's IP that lets me come play in their sandbox or something on my own.
You know, you always seem to play. Like, I saw an interview with you where you talked about your character, and it looks like your character is like some sort of lawful evil alignment in D&D. And then you're playing Deathstroke, you know, and you're into the you know, obviously the evilly sounding metal stuff. Do you look at these places as being kind of like an outlet to also, you know, experiment with this sort of stuff that you talked about earlier, like this darker side of our personalities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the scripts that I'm most attracted to or the ones that I get most excited about are the ones that are, you know, they're shock value. You know, we would go to True Blood and we would do our table reads, and we would, like, there was, you know, audible gasps and, oh, whoa, you know, like people would start clapping out of nervous tension because of the crazy things we were reading that were like highly illegal in the real world. You know, if you did that, they'd lock you up without a key. You know, so those are the things that are exciting, to be able to go to those places that other people are scared to go to or that you can't go to. You know, those are the things that make you the most excited, is when you can step out and be something other than what you can be within the confines of reality. And I think that's always been interesting to me.
Like looking back, True Blood had some awesome music too. Like there's that Best Coast Iggy Pop collaboration. that it's a pretty sick song. I go back and listen to that. Like it was a really cool show, and I think the music is something that people didn't really talk about enough with it.
No, unfortunately, they didn't. No. Well, I think in certain circles, in certain circles, people knew. But yeah, I think, yeah, looking back, I mean, shoot, they were, excuse me, they were, yeah, no, I was, that actually, that was a big thing. But I think HBO has a long history, through that period, like the golden era period, whether you go back to the Sopranos, even Sopranos, The Wire, certainly True Blood. Those were, if you go back and watch those shows again, the soundtracks are incredible.
Well, even
Just
Oz with
wild.
Evan Seinfeld, your friend from Biohazard.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This has been amazing. And at some point down the line, if you ever want to come back and nerd out, Joe, please know the door is always open. But can I trouble you with one or two more questions?
Sure. Yeah, hit me.
Number one, you mentioned your friend Paul White, Big Show, and also you did movies with Kevin Nash, Big Sexy. Were you a wrestling fan at all? Because that is also my D&D like obsession.
Yeah, well, I also did a movie a long time ago with Ken Kennedy,
Oh,
who's
really?
so that was produced by WWE. So yeah, so I am no stranger to working with wrestlers and hanging with wrestlers. Yeah, I was a huge fan growing up. There's a picture that is lost, that was lost. Someone stole. I went to go see a Social Distortion show down at the House of Blues in Anaheim, and I brought a camera with me at the time, disposable camera, because this was the year 2001. So I had a camera with me, and they wouldn't let me bring it inside. So I went, I snuck around, looked every direction, and then like buried it under the roots of a potted plant in downtown Disney in Anaheim. Went into the Social D show, had a great time, hung out with the guys backstage, came back out, and the camera was gone. On that camera were a bunch of photos of me with the late Randy Poffo, aka the Macho Man, in his Bonesaw McGraw gear.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
On the set of Spider-Man.
Yeah, rest in peace.
Who was my favorite wrestler of all time, who I was for Halloween one year. I love old school wrestling. I can talk about it like ad nauseum. I hosted Monday Night's Raw from the Barclays Center in Brooklyn with Arnold one night and Hulk Hogan. So yeah, no, I'm a huge old school wrestling guy, I should say.
The last thing I want to do ask you though is I've always kind of tossed this over in my mind, and it's been a quagmire of D&D thought for me. Isn't true neutral truly the most evil alignment? Because you can switch at any time where your beliefs are.
Yeah, I mean, this is a debate I think we've been having recently, which is like if you're going by the alignment system, somebody asked me what's worse to have in your party, chaotic evil or lawful evil. And I was like, well, chaotic evil is the devil, but it's just going to be a rough ride the whole way. It sucks. It's going to suck because that person's not going to play well with the group, but it's just going to, they're going to try to kill you probably. Lawful evil, they're going to play nice because they've got a long play. And there's something they're not telling you about. And the closer you get to finishing your goal is when you really have to be aware with a lawful evil character because, they're going to find a way to engender themselves to you. And then they're going to, they're the scorpion and the toad. They're going to take off. As far as neutral goes, man, yeah, I've had neutral characters in parties and I've DM'd watching, kind of like neutral characters in parties. And it can get frustrating for the other players, I think. Because I think especially if anyone played team sports or comes from a team sport dynamic or works well within a group, there's a madness that's created with like, why did you just do that? Why wouldn't you do the thing that benefits all of us? And I think also like when you get into splitting the party, I mean, the foyer of my house, there was almost a fist fight once because one of the guys split the party, he just wanted to go adventuring rather than back up the guy who was in some room getting attacked. And he almost lost his character. And he was like, you ever do that again, I'll effing kill you. I'll fuck. I mean, you, I swear to God, it was like heated.
Wow.
So that's what I have to say about that neutral stuff. It's like, oh man, like just, it's just, it's better when everyone plays in a team, but I understand your need to try to do something different.
Well, Joe, anytime you want to come back on the show and play on this team, please know the party is always open.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Joe, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Joe will be back at some point in the near future. Maybe we'll have a Dungeons and Dragons game. Maybe he'll DM a game for us sometime. Probably a lot of demand for him to DM Dungeons and Dragons games. So I'm not going to hold my breath on that one. But he's going to be back for a part two at some point in the future. What a fun conversation. It's great when you like see someone for years and you're like, yeah, like, I wonder if they're cool, you know? And then they turn out to be fucking cool. It's not always like that, but when it is, it's awesome. And speaking of awesome, next week on the show, we're keeping the awesome train rolling around here because going in a completely different direction, but still keeping it really heavy. Next week on the show, from the gods, one of the greatest bands of all time, from Neurosis, the God, Steve Von Till. That's right, Steve is on the show. We talk all about Neurosis. We talk about all his solo work. We talk about his new book of poetry. We talk about Spaz. We talk about Green Day. We talk about Gizm. We talk about, oh my gosh, this is a monster of an episode. I can't wait for you to hear it. That's going to be coming up later on this week on the show. And that's it. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We need to protect trans kids. We need to help trans people protect themselves. Go out there right now, get yourself informed, read up on what's going on in this world, on people's struggles, donate money if you can, just try and contribute, try and just stand up and smash fascism wherever you see it. We live in a world that right now, it's in a bit of a crisis, lots of crises facing our world. So we don't need Nazis as one of them. So fuck that fascism shit. And remember also sign your organ donor cards, because you don't need those organs anymore by the time they come looking for them. They're just dead weight at that point. Do something creative. You might as well go out and just try it. Try and do something. It can help. It can help your mental health. It can maybe help someone else too if you decide to put it out in the world. But you don't have to put it out in the world. Just do something as an outlet for yourself. Try it. Make your own culture. Wear a mask, please. Wear a mask. We're gonna get through this thing. Please do that. And once again, I've been trying meditating, and it's really working for me. I'm not saying it's gonna work for anyone else. I would never pretend to have answers for other people. But if you're like me and someone that thought, it's not for me, it's never gonna work, try it and stick with it and see what happens. Because I didn't believe in this shit at all. And I found it's given me a little bit of, I don't know, perspective, clarity, all the buzzwords. So that's it. That's it. All right. I don't have anything more to ramble on about, I don't think. Thanks for listening. I love you. Have a good week.